Today we're going to begin a new message that will take several weeks to complete. We're going to look at one of the stories that Jesus told. By the way, this is a painting by Rembrandt. I hope the resolution is such that you can see it. And it's actually called The Rich Man. It's anachronistic for the story we're going to tell, but it just seemed to capture the visual imagery that I was looking for as I was thinking about this parable. Jesus tells a story about the unjust steward, the unjust manager. And we're going to look at that story. And Jesus told it to make a point. But it seems that his point was a little obscure, a little hard to catch, because on the one hand, he seems to be saying something, and it's very clear that he's saying it. But the thing that he's saying goes cross-grained to everything else that we know about what it means to be a good person. Everything else that we know about other places where Jesus has talked about being a good person. So telling this story and understanding this story is a bit of a puzzle. Is Jesus trying to tell us that we shouldn't be good people? Is Jesus trying to tell us that a little bit of cheating and a little bit of dishonesty is okay if you're under a lot of pressure? Is Jesus trying to tell us that the ends justify the means? What's going on here? So we're going to look at this story of Jesus. But in fact, what we're going to be doing is looking at the way that we tend to look at Jesus' whole message, how we tend to interpret his life and his teachings. And we're going to be asking ourselves, did we misunderstand this thing? Did we get it wrong? Have ways of thinking crept into our lives over the centuries such that we actually misinterpret the core meanings of the life and the message of Jesus? Now, today is just an introduction. Today, we're not even going to think about the story. We're actually going to think about how we think. And then next week, we're going to take how we think and we're going to apply it to the story. So we're not going to get to the story itself. Actually, at the very end, I'm going to read it to you. So you'll know we're at the end when you hear me read the story. Then you'll know we're done. Today, we're going to set ourselves up for the rest of the message. Now, this, of course, begs that you hear the rest of the message, because without it, all of this context setting of today doesn't make sense. I feel a little bit actually self-conscious because I'm going to stand up here today and I'm not going to talk about things that are all that spiritual. I'm not going to talk about anything except some historically conditioned ways of thinking. And so the thing that bothers me about that is that we don't get to what we stand here for, the purpose of spiritual formation. However, I thought as I was weighing this and considering it, that it's worth us to give this a setup because it's going to radically change how we come to this story next week when we read it. So let's begin with an image. Let's begin with the image that I call the parable of Fred the Goldfish. Now, you're going to have to imagine with me Fred and Wilma. Now, we've only got Fred's picture up on the wall, but Fred lives with Wilma, and Fred is a fish in a bowl. Only Fred's an imaginary fish, because in our story, Fred has a memory, and I don't know that goldfish have memories, and Fred thinks about stuff, and I don't know that goldfish think about stuff. And in this imaginary story, Fred lives a whole lot longer than my own family history would indicate that goldfish live. Because in my family history, goldfish live about 2 or 3 days. Now, admittedly, we are a family of fish killers. We did not set out to be fish killers. As a matter of fact, we tried to be fish collectors and fish appreciators, and we've tried lots and lots of times. But try as we might, we cannot keep a goldfish alive any longer than 3 days. As a matter of fact, Haven has now gone off to college, and she has roommates, and she has suite mates, and she has floor mates, and they all decided it would be a good idea for them all to go get pet goldfishes. The curse has spread. Nobody on her floor was able to keep that goldfish alive any longer than 3 days. So not only is she a fish killer, she has spread the disease. But in our imaginary story, this fish lives for a long time. This fish lives a month. Fred is a special, special goldfish because he and Wilma live a whole month, have a baby, that baby lives a month, they have a baby, that baby lives a month, and so forth and so on. Now, in Fred's world, in this, our parable of Fred the goldfish, a few things show up in his bowl every day quite mysteriously. First of all, food just shows up on the top of the bowl every day. The second thing that shows up on his bowl every day is a single drop of purple food coloring. Now, Fred and Wilma, they don't notice the change very much right up front at first because it's not that much of a change. A single drop in a whole bowl of goldfish water doesn't make the water very purple. But over time, the drops begin to accumulate. And after a year, 12 generations of Fred and his spawn have lived and have died, and now the water is as purple can be. And the generation that is alive now at the end of this year can't even remember the days of clear water. They weren't even born at that time. Purple water has become for them the norm. Now you have to imagine the perspective from Fred's great-great-great-great-great-great-granddaughter who looks up and says, hey, purple is the way that it should be. Now for her, like all of the generations, given that they have this only 30-day lifespan, one day is for them like 2 years in goldfish years. So every 2 years, one drop shows up of purple in the water, and that's not much of a change year upon year. Even the subtle shifts, if they were noted, would be so incremental as to seem normal. So Fred and all of Fred's descendants get used to purple water. Pretty soon, purple isn't a change. Purple is the way things are, and purple is the way things should be. In fact, if the purple was ever removed, it would be disorienting. Can you imagine how upset Fred's great-great-great-great-grandson would be if ever one day the purple was removed? He would say, hey, who stole our purple? Purple is good. And now our good purple water has been replaced with this clearly inferior water that lacks in purpleness. That's the way things are when we get used to things being away. Now, we did a message in January called Dancing with the Divine. And at the very beginning of that, I introduced the idea of purgatory. And I talked about how over generation after generation after generation, this concept had migrated from being the idea of a few mystics, of a purging of their inner lives as they moved into this next season of life that happens after our bodies die. And it moved from that to the place, generation after generation, where now you were forced to buy a candle to light it for Uncle Louie, and the purchase of that candle would pay for the thing, and you would get Uncle Louie out of eternal soul prison. And so what had happened gradually, each one of those steps making sense, each one being rational, each one being reasonable, each one making sense, had moved from something that had a purity to it to something that was so corrupted and so polluted. That's not unlike adding a single drop of purple to the water every couple of years. Now, what if we're living in purple water? What if right now your water and my water is purple? What if every day we wake up and we hold on to a reality that is a purple reality when it could be a clear reality? Would we know it? I don't think so. Would we be able to see it? I don't think so. If we were to ever see it, how would it happen that we would see it? Well, truth, we just wouldn't. Now, maybe if our great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother could magically and mysteriously come and stand right beside us and look at our world, she might notice the change, and she might be able to say, hey, your world is purple. Why isn't it clear like it could be? But we wouldn't know it. So now, I'm not really talking about purple here. I'm talking about how we see the things we see. I'm talking about things that, by reason of time and shift and drift in worldviews, things we used to see about reality that we don't see anymore. Or things that we didn't used to see that now we do. I'm talking about a shift in the kinds of things that our minds filter out or the kinds of things that our minds keep in. I'm talking about a shift in what we believe is real and what we no longer believe is real. I'm talking about the reality stories by which we live our lives and how they shift and move over time. People live by a central story, and it defines their reality for them. We all believe something. We believe something about things that have happened in the past. We believe about things that will happen in the future. certain things. And we believe that there are a certain set of rules that determine how things happen right here, right now in our lives. We believe that there's a set of rules that determine how things happen in the universe. We believe that there's a set of rules about how things happen on the earth. And that amalgamation of things that we believe becomes for us our reality story. And it determines how we live. That's my daughter Skyping me. Hold on just a moment. Okay, I'm sorry. We're back. I just told her that I was preaching right now, and everyone was laughing because I was taking time out to Skype her. So, what are we talking about? All right. Everybody has a reality story, and it determines how we live, it determines what we do, and it determines where things go. And that sense of things we believe about what has happened, what is going to happen, and the rules by which things do happen, this becomes our reality story. Now, as followers of Jesus, our story comes from the words of Jesus. It comes from the thoughts and the writings of people who have followed Jesus throughout the centuries. And that story becomes for us like the water that Fred swims in. We don't examine it, even though it's the most deterministic thing in how we live. It's so woven into our lives that we accept it unchallenged, even though it is the thing that determines our days. It's the most powerful influence that we have over the way that we think. It's the most powerful influence we have over the way that we feel about stuff, the instinctive responses we have to people, the instinctive responses we have to circumstances. All those things are determined by our reality story, and it is so much wed into us that we don't even think about it. It's just what makes us us. Now, that reality story is what holds us together as a people. Because over time, we begin to share these stories with one another. You live with me, and I live with you. And so consequently, your story bumps up against mine, my story bumps up against yours. And so as we live together, as we act together, as we see together, as we think together, we begin to come to a place of a shared story. We adopt one another's realities. We share one another's stories. And your story, your reality story, begins to look, after a little while, a lot like mine. And because we have a shared story, we become a grouping. What holds Americans together is the shared American story. What holds Raleighites together is the shared Raleigh story. What makes us a race, or what makes us a group, or what makes us or a society, or what makes us Jesus followers, is the story that we have that we share together. Now, as we walk through our lives living with our story, there are other stories that are going on as well, always bumping into ours, we're bumping into theirs, and there's a sense of give and take, there's a sense of influence that goes back and forth between our stories, and I want to talk about three potential stories that live and exist in our society along with us. Let me give you three examples. In our society, one group's story tells us that as human beings, we are made up of a random gathering of matter and a random gathering of energy. And though it's a very complex gathering, it has come to be through a series of random experiences, random processes. And so our past is born of a random explosion. Our present is the complex experience of random molecules and chemicals and energy forming together. And our future is the dissolution of these atoms and molecules from an organized state to a more random state. That's one of the stories that goes on in the society in which we live. Consequently, people who follow this story on their trip through life do very little searching for anything that is transcendent, because their story tells them that it's not there. Their story tells them there is no transcendent. There is no mind behind the universe. There is no purpose behind the universe. It is only randomness. So since there is no transcendent, why spend much time or energy looking for the transcendent? So they do little searching for things spiritual. They do very little to connect to the divine. They're conditioned by their story not to do so. Now, we think that that's just those bad, bad secularists out there. But the same thing is true of us. We've bumped up against that story. And as religious people, we hold the same story as part of our story. Our quest for the divine, our pursuit of spiritual practices, those things often flag over time, and they do so often because there's some part of us that rebels against the story that Jesus tells, the story of the transcendent. Our heads will give assent to Jesus because we define ourselves as Jesus followers. And so our brains give assent to this, but our guts, the deepest part of us, rebels against the story that Jesus told because we believe everything that the other story tells us. We believe that this material world is all there is. We believe that what's really real is what I can see and what I can touch and what I can feel. We believe that what really matters has to do with what's in my checkbook, because that's why we worry about it. We believe that what really matters is how the condition of my body. We look at the things that can be attained or understood or apprehended through the five senses, and we say that's the realest real. And this beyond the dimension of the material world dimension, that's not so real. And we live that way. And we act that way. Now, we don't give mental assent to it, but you look at our actions. If we follow us around with video cameras, that's the way that we're thinking. That's the way that we're acting. That's the way that we're responding, because we immerse ourselves in the material world. Our energies and our efforts are exclusively focused on the material world. And so what has happened is we've got a story. It's a Jesus story. But over time, it's gotten purpleized. Over time, a little drop of purple has just been added to it a little bit each day until we look up, and though we don't say it's true, our Jesus story has been tainted by randomness, by meaninglessness, by an over emphasis of the material and the world of the five senses and the idea that that's all that there is. Well, that's one of the stories that's going on around us. We just swim in it. We didn't make it. We didn't add the purple to it. We just are in it. But there's another story. This is the story of the earth that belongs to people. Now, if you can't see that, that's a picture of Uberman. And if you have read Nietzsche, you know who Uberman is. Some people's story tells them that the earth belongs to them. For some, it belongs to them because they're at the top of the evolutionary food chain. Their brains are the most complex, therefore the earth belongs to them. For others, the earth belongs to them because they hold a special place in God's heart, because they have been given dominion over the earth. But for whatever the reason, the earth belongs to them because of their extraordinariness, because of their uberness. Their story tells them that the past and the present and the future belongs to ubermen and to uberwomen. Consequently, it is to us, as these Uber people, to exercise our powerful wills and to exercise our powerful giftedness, because we can be anything that we want to be when we grow up. Consequently, on their trip through life, people whose lives are influenced by this story have two competing realities that drive them. The first is that when their story tells them that the history belongs to the Uber among us, that the Uber among us own the earth, they find themselves compelled to become Uber. They've been given the same equipment as everyone else, they think to themselves, and so it becomes their responsibility to rise to the challenge, to go forth, find their inner Uberness, then use that Uberness to go out and have dominion over all the earth. It becomes their responsibility to go make it happen. It becomes their responsibility to carve out for themselves the life that they should have. That's the first thing that happens when people are compelled by this story. The second thing that happens when people are compelled by this story is that it becomes very difficult for them to see proper limits to what they can do, proper limits to what they should do. It becomes very difficult for people with this story to see proper limits to what they can have or what they should have. It becomes very difficult for people who are led by this story to see what they can be or what they should be, having any limits at all. Because this world is all theirs to have. So if they don't have it, they should. This world is theirs to have, and if they don't, it's just a matter of turning the right dial are pushing the right switch until they do finally get what they should have. All they have to do is discover the right thing and then do the right thing, and then everything can be theirs. This story is behind our economy. It's this story that drives our economy. This is why we have such huge consumer influence in the economic fortunes of our society. This story, interestingly, is behind the current economic crisis that we're going through. This story is behind a lot of stress-related disorders. This story is behind a polluted environment. There's lots and lots of bad byproducts that go with this story because we don't know how to set limits, because our story tells us there are no limits. Humility doesn't make sense in this story. Preserving the earth doesn't make sense in this story. Saying no to wonderful opportunities doesn't make sense in this story. Stepping away from possessions, stepping away from prestige, stepping away from power, these things never make sense when this reality story is in play, because it is our heritage and it is our obligation to accumulate as much as we can accumulate. In fact, this reality story defines American marketing. It tells people that their highest purpose and their society's highest purpose is to accumulate as much abundance as possible. They should maximize their pleasure and they should minimize their pain for the few short years that they get to walk on this earth, and that is the highest aim of their humanity. And whatever gets them to be in a bad place is a bad thing. And whatever gives them more possessions, gives them more happiness, gives them more pleasure, is a good thing. What takes it away is bad. What adds it to them is good. In this story, there's very little reason to manage consumption, little reason to limit what we take from the earth. There's very little reason to be owners of the earth instead of renters, as we just talked about in this last series. We think of this story as being reserved for those horrible, greedy Wall Street industrialists. But the truth is, it's the common underlying story that has purpleized American Christianity. Because what we say is that God gave us dominion over the earth. And so consequently, it's ours to own, it's ours to use, it's ours to enjoy. Consequently, many sects of Christianity pay very little attention to the environment. Many sects of Christianity pay very little attention to living a balanced life where we possess what we should possess and nothing more, where we own what we should own and nothing more. Many sects of Christianity, influenced, purpleized by this story, pay little attention discerning the good of life that comes in balance of what we should and what we should not do, what we should and what we should not have, what we should and what we should not be. This, influenced by this story, much of American Christianity, many sects within Christianity, pay very little attention to the idea of simplicity that breeds peace. It's not just the story of the materialists, and it's not just the story of the consumerists out there. It's in the very water we swim in. We can't help but see Jesus' story through the lens of this story that affects so much of our lives. So, that's a second common story. A third common story that goes on in our society, and that is that we are in life and death competition with each other. This world, this story tells us, is a zero-sum game in which if I win, someone else loses, and vice versa. If someone else wins, I lose. American Christians have been battling with evolution for a long time. It's just been one of the problems that has been out there that Christians have felt they needed to fight with. I think it was an unnecessary battle. But while the church was battling this godless idea of evolution, this godless idea of natural selection and the godless idea of survival of the fittest, what we did is we just opened the back door wide up and we said, come on in and bring in your idea of competition for scarce resources. And let that define our reality. Because what came coming right through the back door was this idea that there are only a few resources and we've all got to scramble to get them. And so if I get it, you don't. And if you get it, I don't. And we see it happening in our own hearts all the time. When someone does something very, very well, part of you feels really good for them. But you have to be honest, there's a little part of you that feels really bad when they do well. If someone gets a good job, if someone succeeds in business, if someone has a successful marriage when you don't have a successful marriage, you think to yourself, ah, there's that twinge inside. I should have done that. I should have had that. I should have been that. If someone writes a book and you think to yourself, I could have written it, you think, oh, why didn't I write that? If someone invents something, you think, why didn't I invent that? I should have. I should be doing more with my life. When someone else succeeds, we feel like I should be doing more. I should have won. If someone else capitalizes on a good idea, now that idea is used up. And it's going to be all the harder for me to hit on my really good idea. Now that resource is used, now that idea is used. And we can't help it. We're Americans. We grew up here. It was in the water we were swimming in. We can't help but then just import that right in and put it overlay right on top of the Jesus story. It's just the way things are. I can't help but absorb any one of these three stories and more besides. These things are the glue that hold us together as a society. It's what makes Americans Americans. It's the shared story that we all are living in. And we can't help but apply that to the Jesus story. These stories are like the water in Fred's bowl. We didn't turn the water purple. We barely even noticed when it happened. It's just the way things are. And these stories are in our guts. And these stories are in our brains. And these stories are in our histories. And they're in our families. And they're in our feelings. And they're in our instincts. And we never question them. They just run in the background. They silently define everything that we do, but they go totally unexamined. We never look at the stories any more than Fred looks at the water. Now, before I talk about this slide, I want to apologize for this slide. I looked everywhere for a Jesus that didn't look so Anglo. I looked everywhere for a Middle Eastern looking Jesus, and I'm telling you, you just can't find them. They're not out there. So here's the idea I want you to get from this picture. Here is Jesus telling superior stories to people. All right? That's the idea I want you to get from the picture. Jesus telling superior stories to people. Here's the idea I don't want you to get from this picture. Jesus telling Anglo-American stories to people, all right? Because they're not necessarily the same thing. In any case, we're Jesus followers. And the whole reason that we're Jesus followers is because we believe Jesus' reality story. We believe Jesus' life, and we believe Jesus' message, and we believe that those comprise a story that describes reality in such a way that we really get it. And we believe that Jesus' story connects us to truth, and we believe Jesus' story connects us to beauty, and we believe that Jesus' story connects us to reality. And as Jesus' followers, we believe Jesus was really onto something. He knew something unique about truth and about life and about the way and about light. And we, like generations of people before us, we have followed this story. But, like Fred in his goldfish bowl, every generation has followed Jesus a little bit and has tended to drift a little bit more and a little bit more influenced by the stories of our society. I didn't think anybody'd read that far. In the first service, they didn't. And without us knowing it, before long, we're just influenced, we're influenced, we're influenced. And then pretty soon, do we have the Jesus story? Or do we have some hybrid version that we don't know? Now, Jesus' story tells us, for example, that love is the realest experience that a human being can have. That love defines God, that love defines the universe, that love defines reality. And we read that story, and as followers of Jesus, we say yes, yes, yes to that part of the Jesus story. But we live around this random, chemical, material world, five senses story long enough, and it creeps in a little bit each year, a little bit each year, a little bit each year. And each year, love becomes just a little bit less divine. Love becomes just a little bit less transcendent. There's just a little bit less of the transcendent to pursue. There's just a little bit less of the preciousness that we would bring to the pursuit of love. And with no transcendence to pursue, our experience of divine love begins to go cold. and it begins to become a distant echo of something that we heard from long ago, rather than being an authentic, vibrant experience of our spirituality today. And consequently, that part of the Jesus story, we still say the words, but it's lost any sense of meaning that is tied to an authentic experience. Jesus' story also says that we are to be stewards of the earth, that you and I, as followers of Jesus, have been given a mission. And this mission is to go out onto the earth and make it on earth as it is in heaven. But with this earth dominion story going on around us, each year we become just a little bit more of a user, a little bit more of a renter, a little bit more of a consumer. And pretty soon, Jesus' mandate for us to go forth into the earth and own it and make it on earth as it is in heaven, that idea goes into the back burner. And pretty soon, we find ourselves thinking that it's God's idea that we become consumers, and God's idea that we become users, and God's idea that we become renters. Jesus tells a story in which there is enough on this earth for all. He tells us a story in which when we go and harvest our grain, we leave a substantial amount of it still in the field so that everyone will have something. He tells us a story that when we come to the end of 50 years, everyone returns any land that they've had to sell. Everyone's debts are forgiven every 50 years. He tells us a story in which we will loan money to each other, but we'll never charge interest. He tells us a story when we look out for one another's well-being instead of devouring one another in the pursuit of our own well-being. He tells us a story in which none of us are a success until all of us are a success. But we've been living in this dog-eat-dog story for a long, long time, and it's influenced us, and the water gets purpler and purpler each day, and finally we don't see it. Soon we're saying, we're telling the Jesus story in such a way that we get to be the Uber consumers and we get to be the Uber users and we get to be the ones who conquer over all and we get to be the ones who are the haves, and they understandably are not the haves, they are the have-nots because we're on God's side or we're on Jesus' side or because we're smarter or because we're more Uber for some way. And soon we're telling this story like it's Jesus' idea. Like this is the way Jesus intended it to be. It was his idea that we'd be at the top of the food chain. Of course, we're the praying ones. Of course, we're the serving God ones. We're the doing the right thing ones. And so, of course, we should have everything, and all those other people should not. And it's not long before our Jesus story becomes unrecognizable from its original form. And especially when it stops working, when God doesn't put us at the top of the food chain, and when we don't get all of our prayers answered, when all the good things happen, at those times people get really upset because the story's not working the way the story's supposed to be working, and sometimes they even abandon Jesus' story altogether, not recognizing that they were abandoning a perverted form of Jesus' story. In fact, each of these societal stories, and others besides them, gets added into Jesus' story, and we end up telling a bastardized version. It's part religious jargon, it's part social conformity, and it's only a small part, the kernel of what Jesus actually told. Those poor great-great-great-grandchildren of Fred who never saw clear water, and those poor great-great-great-great-grandchildren of Jesus who never heard the true story. So, what I'm going to do today is I'm going to read to you one of Jesus' really hard-to-understand parables. And all that I'm hoping you get out of it is perplexed. All I'm hoping you get out of it is bothered. Because my suspicion is we can't understand this story because the water is so purple it doesn't make any sense to us. We can't understand this story because we can't put ourselves in the place that Jesus was when he was telling this story. And next week, we'll begin to think about it together. All I'm going to do today is just read it. Now, the title of it is, if you have an old version of the Bible, it's called The Unjust Steward. If you have a newer version of the Bible, it would be The Unjust Manager. Now, here's a hint about where we're going. Jesus didn't give the story that title. Some later person, some other generation, some publisher gave the story that title. That's an overlay. Jesus, I think, would have probably objected to the title, the unjust steward. This week, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to ponder the parable. I'd like you to talk about it with your friends. I'd like you to ask your friends what they think is going on in this story. And I'd like you to consider what you think is going on. Why would Jesus tell a story that honors the scalawag? Is Jesus saying that the end justify the means? All those questions I asked at the beginning, is it okay to cheat one's employers when you're really in a pickle? Is this the story that Jesus tells in other places? It doesn't seem so. Why would he tell it here? And if you get really industrious this week, here's what I'd like you to think about. What does your interpretation of this parable say about your own reality story? What does the way that you interpret this story say about the color of the water you're swimming in? Right now, in our nation and in the world, capitalism is up for review. This fantastic economic philosophy that has been the engine behind so much of human progress, people are beginning to question it. People are beginning to wonder if built right into this wonderful thing, that the seeds of its own demise are there waiting to come out. People are wondering how it will have to be rethought in order to avoid disasters like the one that we're in the midst of right now. So, what a great time for us to be thinking about a story that includes money, it includes relationships, it includes ethics and how they relate to relationships and money, and it considers how does one save one's own skin when times are really tough. So, what a great time to be reading this story. So ask yourself, what is Jesus saying in the story? Ask yourself, are we living in purple water? And now let's finish by reading the parable together. From Luke 16. Jesus told a story to his disciples. There was once a rich man who had a manager. And he got reports that the manager had been taking advantage of his position by running up huge personal expenses. So he called him in and he said, "What's this I hear about you? You're fired. And I want a complete audit of your books." The manager said to himself, "What am I going to do now? I've lost my job as a manager. I'm not strong enough for a laboring job, and I'm too proud to beg. Ah, I've got a plan. Here's what I'll do. And then, when I'm turned out into the street, people will take me into their houses." Then he went at it. One after another, he called in the people who were in debt to his master. He said at first, "How much do you owe my master?" He replied, 100 jugs of olive oil. And the manager said, "Here, take your bill right now, sit down, quick, write 50. And the next he said, "And you, what do you owe?" He said, "I owe 100 sacks of wheat." He said, "Here, take your bill right now, quick, write down 80. Now here's the surprise, Jesus said. The master actually praised the crooked manager. And why? Because he knew how to look after himself. Streetwise people are smarter in this regard than law-abiding citizens. They're on constant alert, looking for angles, surviving by their wits. Now I want you to be smart in the same way." I'm really hoping that bothers you. We'll get to it next week. Lord, may our stories be pure. May the light in our hearts be pure, and may the life in our souls be pure. May we draw closer to truth and closer to beauty, and closer to reality, ever closer to the divine. May we live from a story that more purely reflects all that is peace and goodness and life and freedom, all those attributes and characteristics of the divine. May our lives reflect a truer story by living out of kindness and compassion and thoughtfulness and consideration for other people. And Lord, may we be clear truth tellers as we would tell our stories. May we tell stories that are not polluted by the purpleness of time, by historical interpretations, clouded by the accumulated barnacles that go on stories year after year after year. May we tell a story that is true in life and light. May we speak wisdom, and may we touch people with healing and with love and with divine presence. Be that so among us, Lord, in Jesus' name, amen. Well, if you would, please prepare your tithes and offerings. And as you're doing that, last week I talked about one way to be generous. And I talked about making space for people to eat together. And I wanted to underscore that and reiterate it. It's very important. It's very spiritual to make space for people to eat together. What a great way to use our generosity. Because eating together feeds community, eating together feeds spirituality, and eating together feeds influence. So if you're hospitable, I encourage you to make space for people to eat together in your home. If you're not, I encourage you to invite people to go to Starbucks with you or to go to Applebee's with you. That you would spend time and you would spend energy and you would spend effort and you would spend money and you would be generous in making place for people to eat together. Because when you do that, you create the fabric of community. And the fabric of community is the environment in which spirituality thrives. And so, as newcomers come to our church, embrace them. People you don't know well, embrace them. Make space for food in a way that is authentic and fits you. And remember what I've said about generosity. Where generosity abounds, the Spirit of God is palpable. So I encourage you to live generously. Lord, I pray your blessing upon these, your people. The blessing of all that is divine, of truth and wisdom and life and light. And Lord, I pray that as we make steps forward into the things that we more clearly understand are the way of our God, that there would attend those steps forward, the encouragement, the affirmation, the belief, the clarity, that we would begin to walk the ways of our God unimpeded. Be that so among us, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.